engine. Until the ill-conceived global COVID lockdowns of industry and transportation that began in March 2020, the demand and supply of diesel fuel was well-balanced. The sudden lockdowns, however, collapsed diesel demand for truck, transport, autos, construction, even farming. Unprofitable refineries were closed. Capacity declined. Now, as world production returns to a semblance of pre-COVID normal, diesel reserve stocks worldwide are dangerously low, especially in the EU, which is the world's largest diesel consumer, but also the USA. At the start of this year, world diesel stocks were already dangerously low, and that drove prices sky high. As of October 2022, before impact of the Ukraine crisis, diesel and related stocks in the U.S. were 21% below the pre-COVID seasonal average. In the EU, stocks were 8% or 35 million barrels below the pre-COVID average level. In Singapore, the Asian hub stocks were 32% below normal. Combined, all three regions' diesel stocks were alarmingly low, some 101 million barrels below the same point last year. Between January 2021 and January 2022, EU diesel fuel prices had almost doubled, and that before the Ukraine sanctions. There were several reasons, but primary was the soaring price of crude oil and supply disruptions owing to global COVID lockdowns and the subsequent resumption of world trade flows. To add to the problem, in early March, the Chinese Central Bank imposed a ban on its exports of diesel fuel to ensure energy security amid Western sanctions on Russia. Add to that, the recent Biden administration ban on imports of all Russian oil and gas, which in 2021 included an estimated 20% of all Russian heavy oil exports. At the same time, the EU, in its ever-ideological wisdom, is finalizing a ban on imports of Russian coal with bans on Russian crude oil, diesel fuel, and gas, reportedly to follow. On April 4th, average price per liter of diesel in Germany was 2.10 euros. On December 27th, 2021, it was 1.50 euros, a rise of 40% in weeks. Following the unprecedented USA and EU sanctions against Russia, following the Ukraine military campaign after February 24th, more and more Western oil companies and oil traders are refusing to handle Russian crude oil or diesel fuel for fear of reprisals. This is certain to escalate so long as fighting in Ukraine continues. The CEO of Rotterdam-based Vitol, the world's largest independent energy trading company, warned on March 27th that rationing of diesel fuel in the coming months globally was increasing likely. He noted Europe imports about half of its diesel from Russia and about half of its diesel from the West Asia region. That systematic shortfall of diesel is there. On April 7, David McWilliams, a leading Irish economist formerly with the Irish National Bank, sounded an alarming note. Not only is oil going up, diesel is going up, and there is a real threat diesel will run out in Western Europe over the course of the next 2 or 3 weeks, or maybe before that. We import a significant amount of our diesel. It comes from two refineries in the UK, where it's first processed. Those refineries do not have any crude at the moment, so we are basically running the economy on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, he added. We have not just an oil crisis, we have an energy crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen in 50 years. According to him, the reason diesel stocks are so low is that the EU countries found it far cheaper to outsource oil and diesel to Russia with its huge supply. The situation in the USA is not better. For political reasons, the true state of diesel fuel crisis is reportedly being downplayed by the Biden administration and the EU. Inflation is already at 40-year highs in the US. What the unfolding global diesel fuel crisis will mean, barring a major turnaround, is a dramatic impact on all forms of truck and auto transportation, farming, mining, and the like. It will spell a catastrophe for an already failing world economy. Yet governments like the German Ampel Traffic Light Coalition, with their insane zero-carbon agenda and their plans to phase out oil, coal, and gas, or the Biden cabal, privately see the exploding energy prices as further argument to abandon hydrocarbons like oil for unreliable, costly wind and solar. The real industrial interconnected global economy is not like a game of Lego toys. It is highly complex and finely tuned. That fine tuning is being systematically destroyed, and all evidence is that it is deliberate.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the political crisis in Pakistan, a history of American interference in the country, and external dimensions of Imran Khan's ouster. And we shall also take a look at efforts by Western and Eastern power blocs to court India in the wake of the Ukraine war and growing strains in New Delhi-Washington ties.
Amid the deepening political crisis in Pakistan, opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif has taken over as a new premier, with the cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan back on the streets, mobilizing his supporters against what he calls an imported government. Khan's repeated claims that the United States orchestrated the regime change conspiracy against his Pakistan Tehreek-Insaf government has once again brought to fore America's interference in the Muslim-majority country's internal affairs, both in the civilian and military spheres.
The U.S. military-industrial complex has a long history of interference in other countries, including Pakistan. Back in 1958, the notorious American spy agency, CIA, engineered the first military coup in Pakistan, which ended 11 years of civilian rule in the South Asian country. It brought to power a U.S.-friendly military dictator, General Ayub Khan. That set a dangerous precedent and paved the path for subsequent military coups. The country's 75-year history has been marked by multiple military coups, corruption scandals, and political infighting. U.S. interests in Pakistan have primarily been influenced by the country's strategic location. In the 1950s and 1960s, Pakistan was made part of the U.S.-led Cold War alliances to contain the communists because of its location close to the southern reaches of the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, Pakistan was used by Americans to overthrow the Soviet regime in neighboring Afghanistan because of their geographical proximity. After the events of 9/11, Americans again roped in Pakistan to fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The 20-year military adventure turned into a big disaster. Over the years, rulers in Pakistan maintained close ties with the U.S. for their survival and to keep the funds flowing. That proved to be Imran Khan's undoing, as he took a different path and tried to assert his independence.
The overthrow of the Imran Khan government in Pakistan and the ensuing political crisis has many external dimensions. The recent developments in Afghanistan and Ukraine led to an escalation of tensions between Washington and Islamabad, and Khan's calculated move to forge stronger alliances with regional powers, China and Russia. The new coalition government led by Shahbaz Sharif, who is considered close to the military establishment, is likely to repair Pakistan's ties with the U.S. in a way that relations with countries like Russia and China not to be affected.
Imran Khan rose to fame in the 1980s as a flamboyant cricketer. He led Pakistan to the historic World Cup victory in 1992. Like on the cricket field, Khan asserted himself in politics as well. He was scathing in his criticism of America's military adventure in Afghanistan, which he deemed unwinnable. In July last year, he censured Washington for the mess it was leaving behind in the war-ravaged country. He also refused to allow Pakistan to be used for so-called over-the-horizon U.S. military operations. That obviously ruffled feathers in the U.S. More recently, Khan refused to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine. He was in Moscow hours before Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the operation, raising eyebrows in the West. His tenure also saw the strengthening of Pakistan's ties with China, a country that continues to challenge America's global hegemony. In February, Khan held talks with Chinese leader Xi Jinping and underscored that China was Pakistan's steadfast partner, a staunch supporter and iron brother. The new premier and Pakistan Muslim League chief, Shehbaz Sharif, is likely to adopt a different approach by mending ties with the U.S. He recently stirred up a controversy with his beggars can't be choosers remarks in the context of relations between Pakistan and the U.S. But experts believe that Pakistan's growing ties with China and Russia are unlikely to be affected.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sabtain Ahmed Dar, Pakistani academic and political analyst at the University of Lahore. Welcome to the program, sir. Let's begin with Imran Khan's claim of a U.S. conspiracy to overthrow his democratically elected government. So, what do you think are America's interests in Pakistan?
Thank you, Mehdi, for inviting me to your show. Well, geopolitically, American interest in South Asia, specifically in the region of Afghanistan and Pakistan, since past 20 years is determined by the war on terror and its objectives in this region. We see that since 20 years, it has been engaging Pakistan in relation to their power military apparatus in Afghanistan to eradicate terrorism. This is why they have this, you know, mantra of Pakistan doing more in order to eradicate the terrorism. But unfortunately, United States has not been realizing that after 2001, when 9/11 incident took place, our interests were not aligned. This is very technical because the same people who United States used with the help of us in Afghanistan to stop the army of the Soviets were pitted against us after 2001, and Pakistan was forced to fight their own brothers, which is not possible. And United States do not understand this. This is why Pakistan has been called that it is playing double game with the United States, because while they are receiving aid through the surrender and appeasement model, they are not using it to fight the people in Afghanistan, which they call terrorists. But the truth is that the United States do not want to see an Islamic fundamentalist government taking form in any Muslim country. So to me, the interest of the United States in Afghanistan and Pakistan has always been in relation to military security. And this is why the bone of contention still remains in between them. And there is a transition that is taking place, which I don't see that things will get, you know, better for both of the countries, unfortunately.
Mr. Ahmed Dar, many trace the U.S. military-industrial complex's interference in Pakistan to the 1958 military coup that ended 11 years of civilian rule and installed the first military dictatorship. So what's your take on this?
The interference, Mahdi, you know, started way back even in the, it's a declassified document now. We can search it on Google that when Pakistan, you know, was headless, because for almost 7 years to 8 years, we were not having any constitution, and the sovereign head of Pakistan was Queen Elizabeth II. In that period, you know, Liaquat Ali Khan became the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and he was asked when he visited the Kansas City University, and he asked for United States assistance, because at that time, our Majlis-e-Shura declared that Soviet Union cannot be a strategic ally of Pakistan because of its communist agenda, and they do not believe in any monotheistic or any polytheistic religion, because their religion is money and socialism. So it was quite, you know, effective to have United States as their partner, but that relation was meant to have, you know, equality. It was not, you know, meant to have a certain relation in which Pakistan would be in dependency syndrome. Well, that dependency syndrome came when after Liaquat Ali Khan declared that the world would be a limpid leg if United States is not going to help states like Pakistan. Well, United States agreed to it because it had, you know, its Bretton Woods agenda in 1945, when it wanted to have newly emerging nation states more in their club, where, you know, they would have, you know, the superiority of their U.S. dollar. And eventually, through that, they would access the markets of these newly emerging states. So United States came and said to Liaquat Ali Khan that they want military bases so that they can spy against the Soviets. Liaquat Ali Khan refused that. And he eventually paid the price when he was assassinated. And it is quite evident now with the declassified documents that he was eliminated by the United States.
Now, Mr. Amin, let's come back to Imran Khan again. Do you think his bold and brave stance on America's unwinnable war in Afghanistan, a NATO-provoked conflict in Ukraine, and warm ties with China proved his undoing?
Yes, maybe you are rightly asking this question, because Imran Khan has always been the only leader in Pakistan who is compelling the public that Afghanistan war is an unwinnable war through military actions. You have to talk with those people because they have the tribal system in them. And, you know, the peace resolution will always come through talks. So this, the idea of, you know, having peace in the region has not been welcomed by the United States, because, you know, they always say that, you know, Pakistan has to do more in relation to military action against their very own brothers in Afghanistan. But we know the truth, that all the proxies that has destabilized Afghanistan and Pakistan were and still being created by the United States secretly, and there is a hidden role of the State of Israel and India and Afghanistan to contain the nuclear Pakistan, because as long as Pakistan is a nuclear power, a Muslim country, state like State of Israel cannot encompass major states, Muslim states, and expand their territory in the Middle East, which is their hidden strategic agenda in the Middle East. So this is why Imran Khan is not suitable as a prime minister of Pakistan, because of his Islamic fundamentalist policy. Because Mahdi, you know, it's all about, you know, the wars against the governor system. They do not want to see any model thriving in any part of the Muslim world that, you know, challenges the hegemony of the Westphalian model. So this is why it was very important to conspire against Imran Khan by using the opposition members who have no confidence vote, and the strategy of using horse trading to buy the votes were used by the United States through their stooges in Pakistan to oust Imran Khan. And unfortunately, they have become successful in it.
There you have it, Mr. Ahmed Dar, Pakistani academic and political analyst at the University of Lahore. So glad to have you with us, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shirin Mazari, human rights minister in the Imran Khan government, says people of Pakistan have rejected the imported government brought in by the U.S.-initiated regime change conspiracy. Travel blogger and social media influencer Tehsin Bajwa notes that the way the nation is standing with Imran Khan is unprecedented in Pakistan's history, referring to massive public rallies in support of Khan in Lahore. M.Q. Khan, a lawyer and writer, says he is attending a political gathering first time in his life, and the reason is the American conspiracy against Imran Khan's government.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amidst rapidly changing regional dynamics and the emergence of new alliances, India as a key player is being courted by major Western and Eastern powers. In the wake of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, a stream of foreign dignitaries has made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent weeks. Delegations have come from the US, Australia and Japan, India's Quad partners, as well as from Russia and China, amid hectic efforts to bolster their respective power blocs. Now, what has sparked concern in the West is India's neutral stand on Ukraine.
As the Ukraine war rages on, new global alliances are taking shape. Some countries have chosen to support Ukraine, some have thrown their weight behind Russia, and some others, like India, have decided to remain neutral. Efforts to court the Narendra Modi-led government in New Delhi continue. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited India on March the 31st, the same day as British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. A day earlier, US Deputy National Security Advisor Dalip Singh was in the Indian capital. A week before that, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Modi held a virtual summit, and China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi paid a surprise visit to New Delhi. Japanese Premier Fumio Kishida also held talks with Modi, and so did US President Joe Biden. India's heavy reliance on Russian arms has prevented it from joining its Quad QUAD partners and condemning Kremlin's military operation in Ukraine. New Delhi has also kept up oil imports from Russia in defiance of US warnings. At the same time, the Chinese top diplomat's visit to New Delhi has opened doors for Modi to attend this year's BRICS summit in China, where a Russia-India-China trilateral meeting is likely to take place. So the jury is still out on whether India is to join the Russia-China camp or continue to sit on the fence with its feet on the Western playfield.
In our judgment, it is important that all countries, especially those with leverage, press Putin to end the war. And it's also important that democracies stand together and speak with one voice to defend the values that that we share.
India's growing dependence on Russian arms and cheap crude oil has distanced it from the waning imperial power, the United States, putting the strategic ties on a sticky wicket. Surprised by New Delhi's bold stance on the Ukraine conflict and the continued import of Russian crude, Biden administration officials have warned India and some other countries of potential consequences. But that hasn't deterred New Delhi, which sees Moscow as an indispensable partner.
In a terse warning to India and other countries that have rebuffed Washington's calls to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on April the 13th said they will face the consequences. She said the U.S. and its allies will not be indifferent to countries that have shied away from taking a pro-West position on the simmering Ukraine conflict in a fiery salvo aimed at India. Her remarks came days after President Joe Biden warned India that buying more oil from Russia was not in the South Asian country's interests. He said only India among the Quad countries was somewhat shaky in acting against Russia. He later dialed Indian Premier Narendra Modi, warning him that it was not in New Delhi's interests to boost energy imports from Moscow.
We can truly assert that there's virtually no domain on which we are not cooperating with each other. The nature of our opportunities and challenges are such that they are more effectively addressed through a cross-cutting dialogue.
As it appears, the war in Ukraine has exposed deep fault lines in America's relations with India, which have primarily centered on defense and security cooperation. While the two countries share concerns over China's staggering rise and the threat it poses to them, they are not on the same page on other issues. Also, there appears to be a growing realization in India that the US is an unreliable partner.
Now, to talk more on this issue, we are joined by Dr. Ranjit Birar, political analyst from London. Now, new global alliances are taking shape in the wake of the Ukraine conflict, prompting both Western and Eastern powers to court India. Now, Mr. Birar, do you think India will join any camp, or will it maintain its neutrality?
Mehdi, it's a really interesting question. Anyone who has studied the history of India will know that post its independence, it, of course, was a colonial vassal state of England and achieved independence in 47. And in that post-colonial era, it was a key member of the non-aligned movement. But strategically, it was always very close to the Soviet Union and has remained close in many respects to Russia. And that includes in terms of its military spending, military contracts and military hardware. It has had a historically very close position to Russia, and still more than perhaps 60% or 70% of its military hardware is still of Russian manufacture. And it has an important relationship with Russia, both economically but also militarily. Now, when it joined the Quad, and with the rise of its new BJP Prime Minister Modi, it was seen to make steps to move closer to the United States. And this worried me deeply, that it seemed to be essentially joining the camp of the United States, of United States imperialism. But it seems to have rode back with a couple of very serious steps. One economic, just before the turn of the new year, so in, I think, December 2021, India and Russia signed a very important landmark historic agreement that they would now trade using the currencies of the ruble and the rupee, so trade directly internationally in their own currencies. And this is a very important step for two such large and important economies, in order to bypass what has currently and for the last period historically been the hegemony of the petrodollar economy and of the dollar as the international reserve currency and hence of the hard globally traded currency that allows it as a fiat currency to flout many of the normal rules that would apply to other countries, and therefore sees other countries have to accept unfavorable terms.
Dr. Birar, you mentioned Russia's importance. Now, India refused to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine and defied U.S. warnings to cut import of crude oil from Moscow. So how important is Russia for India's defense and energy sectors?
So as we were discussing, I think it's very important both for India's defense, but probably more for its defense than its energy sector per se. India has its own sources of energy. But, you know, in a world where energy is increasing sharply in price, and energy security is key to the whole of one's economic development and strategy, the energy does matter. And India has recently signed an important contract with Russia to buy Russian gas and oil and coal, and to do so in the currency of the ruble and the rupee. And this will be, you know, not to the liking of the United States, but much to the advantage economically, both of India and of course, of Russia.
Dr. Birar, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned India and other countries of consequences for rebuffing Washington's calls to take a pro-West stand on the Ukraine conflict. Now, the question is, will India be deterred by this?
Well, there were questions regarding this in the Congress, in the Indian National Parliament, and Indian ministers were in fact interrogated. Modi refused, in fact, to meet with Victoria Nuland when she did her tour, trying to reinforce support for United States policy, which is to use Ukraine as a proxy to wage war upon Russia. Modi surprised me by refusing to meet with her, refusing to be treated as a vassal of the United States. And in fact, his deputy prime minister, who answered questions on the floor of the House, said that she didn't dare to directly raise questions of trade with him. And in fact, they are not amenable to being told how to act. Now, clearly, Imran Khan in Pakistan has essentially been toppled from government, yes, via the military, yes, via the opposition, but at the behest of the United States for exercising this kind of, disregard to American foreign policy. But India is a large country. Pakistan is large, has 220 million population, but India has 1.4 billion population and is not likely ordered around. So I've been pleasantly surprised by the independent stance of the Modi administration in this regard.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Barar for being on the program. Hope to have you again. Now let's see some reactions by people on social media.
Author Martin Jacques points to the refusal of India, China and Pakistan to vote against Russia and Chinese foreign ministers' visit to New Delhi, adding that Quad without India means US and two of its vassal states. Monica Verma, a strategic affairs analyst, says India refused to succumb to Japan's pressure on Ukraine, while arguing that New Delhi must pursue its self-interest without pandering to any diplomatic club. Author and commentator Brahma Chelani remarks that the US has made Russia the central target of its foreign policy, and Biden is insisting that friends like India also join the gang against Moscow.
And that was our episode on the US meddling in Pakistan and the external elements of Imran Khan's ouster, and also how the world powers are trying to court India amid the Ukraine conflict. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Seeing the Canadian government's response to what's been happening in Palestine these last few weeks confirms that Canadians do live in a sick society. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Paul Salvatore, journalist. This article is published under the heading Canada is a sick society for as long as it supports Israeli regime terror. Here is more on the issue. Seeing the Canadian government's response to what's been happening in Palestine these last few weeks confirms that Canadians do live in a sick society. In those weeks, near 20 Palestinians killed, thousands more terrorized at Al-Aqsa Mosque during a violent raid in Gaza bombed by Israeli regime forces. Not a word, let alone an official statement or press release from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Disgusting about this is that, despite the silence on Palestine, he did reaffirm his commitment to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, including to Canadian Indigenous peoples. There is just no way he can be serious. When you care about human rights in any genuine sense, you've deep and universal concern for it. And you don't, in words and actions, simply extend such rights when it's easy or convenient, when it gains you favor and support. The Canadian government is helping the Zionist regime's first Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion's mission to eliminate Palestine. He describes the mission in the well-known 1937 letter he wrote in his son, quote, "We must expel Arabs and take their place. Up to now, all our aspirations have been based on an assumption, one that has been vindicated throughout our activities in the country, that there is enough room in the land for the Arabs and ourselves. But if we are compelled to use force not in order to dispossess the Arabs of the Negev or Transjordan, but in order to guarantee our right to settle there, our force will enable us to do so," unquote. Many Canadians, in solidarity with Palestine, are demanding this end, but it's as if the government never bears them. Instead, in contempt of international law and morality, it keeps supporting the Zionist regime, including exporting arms to this regime's military. The government's message is clear. Israel is the friend and Palestine is not. We want you to go along with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine as if that's normal, part of what is to be Canadian and embodied by the example of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau never condemning the fake regime of Israel for all the horror it inflicts. Perhaps the Canadian government is afraid that if they condemn the Zionist regime, they, even though that is in keeping with Canada's expressed commitment to human rights, will be met with the predictable criticism by Israeli supporters, and that's being anti-Semitic. And of course, they don't want that reputation. People realize that to fight for Palestinian justice is to care for humanity. Dovetailing with precepts such as saying no to murder and colonization of religions around the world. The Sikh Society of Canada identified extends to the callous disregard the Canadian government on top of failing to intervene in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine shows Palestinian Canadians. They are suffering tremendously, seeing from afar, geographically, the murder, bombing, and dispossession of Palestinians on a routine basis. The government, however, much as they protest, do nothing substantial about it. What's perhaps most maddening about it is that it is casual, done as if there is nothing serious to worry or be alarmed about. It recalls philosopher Hannah Arendt's observations of Adolf Eichmann during the Nuremberg trials, who described his role as a Nazi killer nonchalantly. The Canadian government's attitude towards Palestine is equally as reprehensible. It is ultimately one of indifference, sparing no urgent action on the part of elected officials to end the Israeli regime brutality. They are a terrorist regime, and much as they may be a friend or ally to Prime Minister, they are not to people. People who refuse to support, let alone turn a blind eye to a sick society, a sick Canadian society. We'll be right back.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there. Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help defuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital, Amman, in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries, but without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Thank you.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Thursday that Russian forces have won the battle for the strategic southern city of Mariupol. Russian forces appear to be in control of the city, including its important but now seriously damaged port. At a joint appearance with his defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin declared that, quote, the completion of combat work to liberate Mariupol is a success. The Russian president offered congratulations to Shoigu and Russian forces. But what is the strategic significance of the latest developments of the war? Mariupol is a major port in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. It is situated between areas held by pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that came under Russian control in 2014. Taking the city now will allow Russia to connect the two areas as it steps up its military campaign in Ukraine's east. Moscow can now secure more of the southern coastline, complete a land bridge between Russian soil and the Crimean Peninsula, and free up more troops to join the battle for Donbass, which is Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. Despite Russia's announcement of victory in Mariupol, hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians are still holding out inside a giant steel factory in the city. Russian forces have tried for weeks to dislodge them, but to no avail. The Kremlin says there is no need for Russian troops to enter the complex passageways of the sprawling Azovstal steelworks. The Russian president ordered his forces to block off the industrial area so that, quote, not even a fly can get through. Ukraine and its Western allies have disputed Russia's claim of complete victory in the city. But Moscow seems to be already looking beyond the southern city. Russian officials say the war's main objective is now capturing the mostly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Last month, Russian forces were driven away from the capital Kiev and northern Ukraine. Things will definitely not be smooth in the east either, as Western nations rush to funnel heavy arms into Ukraine to help it counter the offensive.
The Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO, equipped by NATO, and trained to the standards of NATO. So that is a major factor as to why the Ukrainian armed forces have put up stiff resistance to the Russian army.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced another $800 million to help Ukrainian forces fight in the east. He said this week that Washington and its allies are moving as fast as possible to provide Kiev with the weapons that it needs. According to Biden, the U.S. and its allies are facing a critical window of time where they are going to set the stage for the next phase of this war. Much is at stake in Ukraine for major world powers. The war has been widely described as an escalation of the never-ending tug of war between the West and the Russian Federation. The outcome of the conflict could have far-reaching consequences and may shift the balance of power in the region and beyond.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is entering a new phase, which is focused on eastern Ukraine as the opposing troops remain locked in combat along a 300-mile front line. The Russian Defense Ministry has given the Ukrainian forces an ultimatum to lay down their arms. Ukraine has reached a preliminary agreement with Russia to evacuate civilians. But the United States and its allies seem to be determined to prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to announce within the coming days another military aid package for Ukraine about the same size as the $800 million one announced last week. It will include artillery systems, artillery rounds, armored personnel carriers, and unmanned coastal defense boats. It would bring the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine since the Russian military offensive in February to well over $3 billion U.S. dollars. Kiev has called for additional weapons and support to stave off Moscow's new offensive in the eastern Donbas region, where Russian forces have been amassing after their withdrawal from the Ukrainian capital. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also said Canada would be sending heavy artillery and promised to provide more details. There are some reports that the US is using the Ukraine conflict to prepare for wars against Russia and China. The US military is training to fight in an environment heavily shaped by the Russian military campaign against Ukraine that was launched about 2 months ago. The purpose of this month's war game in California is to prepare for future wars against Russia and China. The report said the role players in the exercise at the Fort Irwin National Training Center in the Mojave Desert speak Russian. About 4,500 soldiers from the 2nd Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division are pitted against the fictional Devonian forces, the exercise's apparent stand-in for the Russians. The enemy fires rockets and missiles in the drill, all while using a sophisticated disinformation campaign to make false accusations against U.S. troops.
So I think that the United States, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. government, the officials within United States politics and economics have their head on straight enough to know that an open war with Russia is against their profit motive, is against their motive for world domination, because there simply would be no world left to dominate.
The U.S. has also warned China that it will face consequences if it helps Russia evade sanctions in its invasion of Ukraine. China has so far refrained from condemning Russia for the invasion and has said Moscow's legitimate security concerns should be taken seriously. There has also been growing tensions between Beijing and Washington and its allies in the Asia-Pacific region, including over Taiwan and the South China Sea. The Pentagon and U.S. lawmakers cited countering China in passing this year's $777.7 billion defense budget.
Just days ago, Israeli occupation forces attacked Al-Quds' Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers on one of the holiest days in the Islamic calendar. Now, in a fresh bout of violence, Israeli forces have again targeted Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Dozens of Israeli military forces have stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinian worshippers into the Flashpoint holy site to secure the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. This is while the day before, the settlers entered the compound amid a heavy military deployment of Israeli soldiers to mark the Passover holiday and perform their own prayers. This year, the Jewish religious occasion coincides with the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan at a time when thousands of Muslims, predominantly Palestinians, usually stay at the holy site for worship, a rare convergence that will drive unusually high numbers of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian worshippers to the old city of Al-Quds. Far-right Jewish groups have even called for raids of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the Jewish Passover holiday and the offering of animal sacrifices in its courtyards, which has not occurred since ancient times. Sacred to Muslims and revered by Jews, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, has long been a flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And it's really pushing the Palestinians out of Jerusalem. It's trying to Judaize the city of Jerusalem. And we saw them attacking completely innocent people, you know, old people, women, children. So it's not really about security for Jewish worshippers.
Palestinians in the occupied territories have reacted to the raids by the Israeli security forces by going out to the streets in support of the worshippers. Israel, meanwhile, is trying to paint a different narrative. The Western-backed media is hard at work painting the Palestinians as the aggressors, even calling the worshippers rioters and terrorists. Israel says its so-called security operation is an effort to protect freedom of worship from violent rioters desecrating the site and endangering the public, but it has a tough task since scores of videos show the opposite to be the case. Palestinians are angry on a wide variety of fronts. They are suffering immensely due to the Israeli occupation. Additionally, they are amazed at the international community's indifference to Palestinian suffering amid the Ukraine crisis. Furthermore, the paralysis of the Palestinian leadership has added salt to their wounds, who seems unable to do anything. The resistance group Hamas, however, has described the crisis as the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes, attempts to Judaize Al-Quds and to perform sacrifices in the Al-Aqsa Mosque to build its so-called temple during what they call Passover. The Gaza Strip, meanwhile, is at risk of another Israeli onslaught. Israeli tanks and armored vehicles have made an incursion into northern Gaza Strip, raising the possibility of another war.
Governments around the world need to stop supporting the Israeli aggressions against the Palestinians. And I can say myself, as a rabbi and as a Jewish person, the Jewish communities around the world have to stop supporting the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians.
A similar Israeli assault on Al-Aqsa during Ramadan last year sparked a military confrontation between resistance factions in Gaza, led by Hamas and Israel. Hamas has said this year Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa and its worshippers is a declaration of war. And sure enough, early on Tuesday, the Gaza Strip came under Israeli assault, reportedly after rocket fire from the Gaza Strip. This is a sure sign that another war may be in the making.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. In the Holy Quran, God says, "Thus do we deliver those who have faith." Is good news for us. It means that by praising God, asking for His forgiveness, acknowledging our sins, and apologizing to Him, we too can achieve salvation. So repenting is done for committing a wrong deed and for not doing things that we must have done and for bad management. It is necessary for both these things. The point that exists is that we refer to the executives of the Islamic Republic as Mas'ul. We describe them as Mas'ul, that as Mas'ul. What does Mas'ul signify? It signifies that we will be questioned, literally meaning the one who is questioned. For what? for the things that we did and the things that we did not do.